almost caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are face prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate fun. Daisy is just the ultimate fun.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You caused confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit grey today.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to The Deepest Lore. I don't know if you've ever seen that little-known film, The Wizard of Oz. You know, the original one from 1939. Now, there's that moment where the witch is just kind of melting into the floor. That's how I feel right now. It's far too hot. My computer says it's 31 degrees in here. So, that's very hot indeed. Mr. D, how are you faring today?
Well, it happens to be very hot where I am as well. In fact, even hotter. It's meant to be, in the high 30s centigrade, which is, for those other people out there, it's the high 90s. So, yeah, very, very hot indeed. But I'm cool as the proverbial cucumber because we are finally continuing our excellent stream.
Also, welcoming back to the Deepest Lore, Alexander Adams, how are you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you very much. I'm a little bit further north than you, so I think we can probably knock off a couple of degrees, but it's still bright and sunny.
Oof, far too hot. Anyway, if I'm a bit quiet, it's because I'm sneaking in the background with my fan on full blast, just trying not to melt. I even got a Diet Coke at the fridge, and it's that hot that it's already starting to lose its coolness, even though I've had it there for, you know, many hours. When a can starts to sweat, you can see like the condensation all down it, you know. So yesterday was the release of my book, The Prophets of Doom. I'll play the little trailer for it in a second, but Alexander Adams is one of the few people in the world who's already read that book, and he got his review out long before it actually even dropped. So you seem to like the book, Alexander.
Yes, I did. I know that publishers and authors kind of hate reviews that come out too early because it misses the push, it misses the bump, as it were. You know, a lot of people look and say, oh, it's not out yet. Well, I'll get it in a couple of weeks, and of course they forget. No, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was it's quite eye-opening. Very clearly written, and if anyone enjoyed the Populist Delusion, you will enjoy this book because it's basically written along the same lines, and I think it very concisely explains who these people were and the idea, and it also sets forward the case for cyclical histories. Anyone who wants to read an even longer review of this book, please subscribe to Bournebrook Magazine. The print edition has a long version, which has not yet dropped.
I was a little worried that the book is a bit dry, but how did you figure? I felt that little bit. I mean, when I was writing it, I was like, is this going to be a bit too academic for everybody who buys it? But what did you think on that front?
I thought it was, it's very clearly written, and you obviously you've hit on, I mean, as you say, you've hit on the key works by these writers. You know, you said you were going to choose sort of a signature volume from their general corpuses and sort of summarize from those. And I think that worked very well because it could get very baggy if you try and sort of incorporate all sorts of political views, but you just basically centered on their theses in their books.
Yes. All right. Well, with that said, I'll play this little promo.
Thank you.
So there we go. In a way, it's kind of fitting that promo, because I do talk, one of the things I talk quite a bit about in the book is heroism and the kind of warrior aristocratic spirit that all of these guys were trying to, in their various ways, get back to.
The chapter on Brooks Adams was quite interesting because I'd never heard of him before, but you talk about him and his relationship with Roosevelt, the first Roosevelts.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt, yeah.
No relation to you, is he?
Brooks Adams is not related to Alexander.
No, not related to him. No. Sorry.
he was actually a relative of the second president, John Adams.
Yeah, John and John Quincy, and yeah.
John Quincy, that he's part of that family. And he's the fourth of four brothers, and he was like the least successful and least well known of those four brothers as well. So he does have a the story I like to tell about Brooks Adams is that apparently he used to wake up every morning with the same kind of lament. He'd wake up and he'd say, see if I can find the bit of the book where I talk about this. Let's have a look. He was sometimes dismissed as a problem in pathology, scorned as the last and the least worthy of the capricious Adams tribe. His older brother, Charles Francis Adams, once quipped that he was a compound of incompetence, egoism, pessimism, and self-appreciation. Always certain and always wrong, poor Brooks. And then the story is he used to wake up every day singing a song of his own invention, which consisted entirely of three repeated words: "God damn it, God damn it, God damn it." So I find that Brooks Adams is kind of an eccentric, strange character at the turn of the century.
But I know him because he was the last of the Adamses to live at Peacefields, which is the estate that John Adams began in the 18th century. In fact, maybe his parents did it. So yeah, Brooks Adams was literally the last of the line. And if people are ever in Massachusetts in America, you can go and visit Peacefields. It's quite beautiful. He was the last of them.
I also have the small matter. Sorry about this extended shill, but it's quite a big week after I've been away for, it's the first week back as business as usual after it's back to school week, as it were, in every respect. And so busy was I over the summer that I actually missed the summer sale. So we're doing the summer sale now in September. It's an Indian summer sale, which is ironic in a way, because we are actually suffering through the oppression of an Indian summer right now in more ways than one. Like Rishi Sunak is the Indian summer over the British Empire, right? Apologies in advance, Alexander, for the mate promo. Here we go.
Oi! Mate.
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 Mate. Mate.
Oh, mate.
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 Call this the Guantanamo Bay school of advertising. What do you reckon? kind of a gentle torture.
Yeah, I think you do that thing of, you know, when you hear someone's playing TV in another room and then suddenly it comes really, really loud and you know that there's the adverts playing. I think you're doing a bit of that, aren't you?
Yeah, but also just endless repetition, you know. I built up a built up a style. You know, we have merit, and just autistically saying the same thing over and over again, I think, in increasingly annoying ways. Maybe that's how all advertising should go. Anyway.
Is it over? Is it over?
It's over. Back. It's over. And would you like to start? We are finishing up today with the end of the career of Francis Bacon. So roughly speaking, from the late 70s, early 80s until his death. And you did have a video, Dee, but do you want to start with that or do you want to start with the images?
Let's start with the images and the video. I think will be more germane when we transition to the 1990s. So, and people who are curious, of course, there are four previous installments of this. I don't mind saying that because it obviously didn't work to not call it a part,
although it didn't work.
No, it didn't work, so I don't care. So this is part five. There are four other parts, of course, with lots of wonderful information and images and anecdotes and conversation. So I've made a playlist, and I will tweet that out later on with this video added to that. And so if people want to watch all of them in sequence, I've got them together on a playlist. So look for that on my Twitter account after the show.
All right, I now have my fan on, so I'm not going to say a lot. I'm going to make the screen bigger, the images bigger, and let you guys take it away. All right.
Okay, so we left off basically the transition from the 70s to the 80s. I think that Bacon's work, I think there's certainly a transition in Bacon's work. I mean, we remember from last time we talked about a picture called Jet of Water, which I think will also is kind of a harbinger of other works of that nature that began in the 80s. But I think there was also a kind of sort of late change up in the manner and configuration and the sort of stylistic choices that Bacon would make. And perhaps we can sort of see that in the work as we go along. So is there anything you want to say, Mr. Adams?
So we'll discuss the work when it comes up. I would say also that his profile is now very high. It was given its first boost really properly in 1945. It gets a bump for the Tate in 62 and then the Grand Palais in 71. But by the early 80s, he is now seen as the grand master of figurative painting. To be fair, and I'm not making this as a dig, but there wasn't very much competition. There's a group of painters called the School of London who are pretty serious painters and, you know, quite significant in their way. But there's relatively few figurative painters. You could also have Baltus in there as well. But Bacon doesn't have much competition. So he's seen as the great flag, you know, standard bearer of figurative art, of the grand masters of painting in the grand style. The portraits, the interior, as well as also the sort of the humanist existential strand that became big in the 40s. He's seen as sort of like as extending that, and it still has credibility. So while some artists like from the 1940s are sort of slip out of view, Bacon never does. Of course, he's alive, which always helps, you know, sort of artist's career tend to dip after they die. But Bacon's is always high through the 60s, 70s and 80s. And by now, a lot of people have sort of hitched their horses to him, as it were, because he's a big money maker by this time. So in the 1980s, he's making serious money. He's exhibiting all over the world, courtesy of Marlborough Gallery. He's getting museum shows. His works are being acquired by museums. He becomes a favorite subject for photographers and filmmakers. So he's quite amenable, although he doesn't give that many interviews. He's very amenable to younger artists, to photographers, to filmmakers. So his image is getting out there. The image of the studio, the famously chaotic studio, is also getting out there, and that's doing great work promoting his art, promoting his worldview. It's not done in a cynical way, I think, but it does certainly have an impact.
And there's also a big change that sort of happens in the early 1980s in the art world. I mean, you know, Bacon had of course weathered the sort of later 1960s with the sort of rise of pop art. You know, partially founded actually in Britain by the likes of Richard Hamilton and other artists. You know, and people of course knowing like R.B. Kitai and Peter Blake and such. And then in the 70s, you know, with kind of minimalism and color field painting and conceptualism and all that. In the 80s, of course, there was in various places, one of the times where there was kind of an awakening in various continents in America and in Europe, a sort of return of figuration and figurative painting. And so so in the early 80s, we see a kind of rise of a younger generation of kind of, you know, neo-figurative artists. And I think, you know, Bacon, he's already there, you know, ready to become the kind of, you know...
Can I ask a little bit about this? Because one of the things that has that did happen between this stream and the last one that we did is that I did a stream on the CIA, and specifically the rather deep and quite disturbing psychological warfare operations that the CIA was conducting in America and in Europe as well. In fact, the CIA's American operations were actually illegal, because the CIA is meant to be a foreign, it's meant to be like a spy network operation abroad, right? And one of the things that came through pretty apart from the revelation that James Burnham himself was running these operations, which was kind of mind blowing, the other thing that came through was a deliberate push from the CIA for Europe and for the art world to embrace the abstract expressionists, which is Jackson Pollock and Rothko and stuff like that. And they had this idea that the abstract expressionism was actually an expression of American freedom and the American ideals, as against the realism of the socialists. So there was this kind of deliberate psyop, right? Now, regardless of the actual merits of Pollock and all of that, one thing that interested me when I was reading through that stuff was Bacon consciously or self-consciously in any way kind of reacting against, like, did he feel that this was like some American thing that was being pushed and that's why he stuck to being figurative? Or
no.
And also, how successful or unsuccessful were those various psyops? Because and how do you place like Bacon's whole career in that context? Because people were asking when it came up.
Yeah. Well, let me quickly go in and say that no, I mean, as far as I know, maybe Mr. Adams can correct me, but Bacon never talked about his work in terms of like being reactive to trends. You know, I mean, and of course, if you watch the streams, you can see the development of his work is very sort of insular and very sort of personal and slow at most points. And so I don't recall any sort of statement, and I certainly don't see reflected in the work any kind of deliberate reactionary sort of impulse towards any kind of great trends in the art world. Now, obviously, I remember, you know, we certainly talked about his use of color over the years, which of course changed radically with in the 1960s, and you almost start to kind of see the slight kind of influence of kind of pop cultural coloration and decorative colors and such start to come into his work, which are very much sort of redolent of that period. But no, I don't really think so, and certainly I don't ever remember reading any sort of statement he made commenting on commenting on sort of political and America, you know, sort of, or America in that way. How about you, Mr. Adam?
Well, first of all, I thought that was a really excellent stream. I really enjoyed that stream. That's some useful book. I don't know the book. I know roughly the arguments, and so I've heard those before. And
apparently, it's sold out everywhere now. So I want her to give me commission for causing a worldwide shortage of that book. But carry on, yeah.
Well, yeah. So I remember that happened with the Wyndham Lewis book. Yeah, as we were doing a live stream on it, that it tripled in price and then became unavailable just live. We could have watched like a sort of a graph of its current price going up as we did the stream. I would first of all urge people to go and listen to that stream, because that's very interesting. Bacon himself was actually quite chummy with Stephen Spender, who was one of the people who was funded by this indirectly by the CIA. Mm-hmm. He didn't see himself in those terms, although we will discuss certainly an exhibition he had in Moscow, which was which has sort of geopolitical ramifications, I mean, indirectly. But first of all, you've got to remember that he was European, and he was seen as very European, and the Americans, by and large, didn't really take to him. A lot of museum directors were heavily invested in abstract art and in pop art. They never quite warmed to Bacon. They were suspicious of him. They were also, you know, quite proud of American painters in themselves. And Bacon was sort of like, was a bit of an oddball. He didn't really fit into the narrative, because, of course, the narrative was various things happen. The Surrealists arise in Paris. Many of the Surrealists are relocated to America during the Second World War. They influence the American painters in America, especially in New York. You have the rise of the New York School and abstract expressionism. And where does Bacon fit into that? Bacon wasn't really a Surrealist. Bacon never spent very much time in America. He didn't have that much influence in America. How do you factor that in? You basically don't. You ignore it. So the Americans kind of pass over Bacon in that sense.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that to some extent, the success of Bacon's career shows that whatever that psyop was didn't work 100%, right? Because it wasn't...
It didn't work very well at all. I mean, the Europeans never really cottoned on to American-style abstract expression. I want to caution people, because I see far too many sort of, you know, quite, quote, normie sphere people, you know, who come to me and say, did you know that you know, all modern art is just a CIA operation? Now, that isn't what the whole basis of this is, you know. I mean, as AA said, it was a sort of program to kind of push a vision of America, you know, through the promotion of certain artists. It wasn't some CIA program to like promote bad art in order to like, you know, psyop everyone. That isn't what they were doing. They were using artists, almost using that artist propaganda in a way. So I think people need to be very careful about that, because I've seen some very stupid takes.
I do have one CIA related revelation though, which I have to share with you guys, because it did start me wondering, like, ooh, did the CIA have any involvement with Francis Bacon? And the only thing that comes up, you guys probably are already aware of this, is this mysterious woman, the unknown woman, right? The CIA used facial recognition software to discover that this woman, who was just known as the unknown woman, 1930s, it's a famous photograph from Soho by John Deakin, was in fact Francis Bacon all along. And other people have kind of been like, oh, well, yeah, but how's he got a cleavage then? And this is, if you type in to Google CIA Francis Bacon, this is the only thing that comes up, the fact that they've discovered that it was in fact Bacon. So were you guys aware of this?
Well, obviously he was friends with John Deakin, which we've discussed already, and he was known to wear women's underwear occasionally under his clothes. So the transvestite thing doesn't really surprise me. Also, you've got to remember that he was in Berlin at about the time that Isherwood and Auden and Spender were visiting. So, yeah, that sort of thing was going on.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were camping it up from time to time.
There we go.
Where were we?
I'll turn my fan back on and carry on.
Right. Yeah. And then the early 80s Neo figuration. Yeah, so there certainly was a kind of resurgent in interest, and of course also collector interest in painting, you know, with a capital P, and certainly figurative art. And you saw it all over the place. You know, there was a big sort of resurgence in Germany, a resurgence in Britain, and Bacon was again well placed to sort of be the, you know, the grand père of British formal painting at the time. So and that certainly did helped again raise his profile enormously, and his prices as well.
Yes, and also, I mean, he was quite friendly towards younger painters, but only if they were very, very minor and they didn't pose any sort of threat. So he doesn't become chummy with any of the artists who become big in the 80s. So he's not a friend of Penker or Baslitz or Polka or whatever, any of those.
No, absolutely. Again, as I said, he was always, as in regard to his art, quite sort of insular, you know, and quite sort of self, you know, sort of self-directed.
He doesn't mind mentioning or quoting people like Duchamp or Richard Hamilton, who no one would ever think had hugely influenced his art, or that he could be accused of borrowing from illicitly. So he was quite happy to mention artists who were sort of very, very tangential to his own style or approach. And he actually actively distanced himself from artists like Giacometti and Auerbach and Lucian Freud, who he'd initially been quite supportive of. And he sort of made a point of sort of evading mentioning them, and he didn't see them socially as much during the 80s.
All right, so this picture is from 1980, and it's three studies for a portrait of John Edwards. Now, I don't know if we mentioned it, but you know, people are familiar with George Dyer as being Bacon's great sort of muse and on again, off again romantic partner in the 1960s and early 1970s. He met John Edwards in the later 1970s, as far as I recall, Edwards became certainly a muse, you know, a sort of later muse for Bacon. You will see his image come up again and again in some of the later works. But it almost, the relationship took on a very different character, almost a kind of a sort of fatherly or sort of protective role that sort of went both ways. I mean, Edwards sort of looked after Bacon, you know, because Bacon was aging. He was in his 70s now. So the relationship was of a different character. Gone was the sort of violence and the kind of competition and the sort of, you know, deliberate sadism and masochism of Dyer and Bacon's interrelations, and of course Edwards was friends and, you know, compatriot of Bacon until Bacon's death. So yes, you will see him again and again in some of these later works.
We'll see in the next few paintings how the style becomes more serene, although we do return to the orange later on. The colours are not sort of jarring or searing. The impasto goes down. Impasto means paste, so that's the sort of the thicker elements. You don't get so much working and overworking. So this is sort of all becomes his late style. Artists go into these sort of late styles, and there don't seem to be common features. So you couldn't say that the late style of an artist is always towards being more painterly, because in Bacon's case, it's becoming slightly less painterly. But this is Bacon's late style we're seeing.
Yeah, yes. And I think that's a good point, that this idea of a relative sort of serenity or sort of relative spareness that you see in these works. It should be mentioned, of course, that we saw Edwards last time. We watched some videos of Bacon and David Sylvester and John Edwards in Bacon's flat and studio. So and you know, he was again from the East End. He was we did mention him because we talked about him being yeah. a kind of running a pub or a bar, and
he ran a pub in the East End with his brother, I think.
Yeah.
I've mentioned before, I don't know if I'll try this on Alexander Adams. I have a largely untested theory that artists who make it long enough, i.e. it has to be somebody who has a long enough career to have a quote-unquote late style. My banner example being Bob Dylan, but you can pick your own, that their late style is actually the full flourishing of the artist they've always wanted to be. I think this is true of Yeats. I think it's true of Bob Dylan. In a way, D, I think it's true of David Bowie. I've come to see that the late Bowie is actually a kind of like, it's like it takes all the elements he's done before, but he's kind of come at peace with it. And this is actually just like, it's almost like they've developed, this is it. Like they've got all their different tricks that they've tried on through all their different things. I never write off a late period for this reason, because I always think that there's something interesting in it. What do you think about that as it pertains to Bacon? Assuming my theory is true for a moment.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah, you do get a sense of freedom for successful artists. So successful artists have a degree of freedom that they get through material security. So they're selling work, their reputation is already established generally. They don't have to fight to be particularly to break new ground, although they could, but they're given a certain degree of freedom, so they don't have to prove anything anymore. And I think that is the case with a lot of artists. And I think with Bacon's case, it was, you know, that he'd already done everything. He'd been extremely influential. He'd been very individualistic. He'd been extremely independent. And so he, by the time he reaches his late stage, he can do what he wants. But he doesn't get lazy. He doesn't stop innovating. He does carry on doing new things, but he's got this certain degree of, you know, independence.
I tell you who else springs to mind as well, which is actually Carlyle, late Carlyle. Like a lot of people said, oh, well, he became self-parodic and he was almost kind of like Carlyle doing Carlyle type thing. But I actually think it's the opposite way. I just think it's like by that point in their career, they've developed their own idiom, i.e. a kind of language in which to express themselves. So that's where you get the kind of, you know, the fully realized authentic self or something like that, some weird thing like that, where it's like, I don't know. I mean, and I always think that critics and, I mean, this certainly happens in music, but happens in other fields as well. They've got a habit of generally being quite kind of critical of the late period because they see it as more derivative or see it as more, you know, oh, it's not doing anything novel or flashy or new or anything like that. But in my experience, some of the most interesting stuff that people produce come from these areas that are written off. I mean, I made a video the other day of a Kinks song, Living on a Thin Line, which is, you know, from one of their forgotten, written off 80s albums. But it's like, well, maybe this is who the Kinks always wanted to be, you know. Carry on.
you certainly find, I think it can be a great advantage, but it can also be a drawback, is when an artist starts quoting himself This can be dangerous because you can just fall into a system of, well, you know, you're just repeating something that you know because it's comfortable. Sometimes you're going back and you're saying, well, no, actually, I want to bring out an element that I didn't bring out in this originally when I did it. So you're sort of rephrasing it, or you're going back, or it's like one of those artists who go back and they record their early songs in a sort of later acoustic version. It can be quite enlightening.
Yeah, and of course, you know, sometimes this is a problem. You know, it's not always kind of, you know, a kind of satisfying settling in. You know, I think of you know, a living example of is the American artist Jasper Johns, who I think, you know, sort of ran into a kind of crisis of quotation, of self-quotation, and sort of languished for years and years, basically throughout the 80s and 90s and 2000s, sort of, you know, doing greatest hits, or, you know, doing increasingly kind of rarefied little, you know, little sort of inward kind of explorations of things that seemed, you know, just tangential to the project. But then, of course, you know, I think that in a way he sort of found himself again. It's not always an easy period, you know. I mean, when we talked about Andy Warhol, for instance, you know, by the kind of later part of his career, he was, you know, many sort of critics had kind of written him off and you know, sort of said, well, basically your moment, and there is a, as you say, tendency of critics to say, well, you know, your great moment was this in the beginning of your career when you had your great innovation that brought you to attention, and we're not going to accept anything else. You know, everything else is going to be you just trying to keep on going. But of course, with Warhol, people remember, you know, his late work. I mean, he returned to painting by hand again. And of course, there was this remarkable rush of very stark religious imagery that suddenly came in, you know, at the very end. And I think that ends up being another sort of factor, is that there's an increasing, I think, sort of, not desperation, but there's an increasing sense of urgency that kicks in, because of course then you know the artist is also facing the prospect of the end for himself, of his own mortality. Certainly something that haunted Bacon, because he had lived so long, and many of the people that he was close to, many of his friends had died, you know, or certainly fading fast. With David Bowie, you know, I famously had a kind of revelation with his later work, which I didn't get before, and suddenly, you know, it sort of all clicked for me. But again, I find it so totally haunted by death. So I think that's another consideration. Same with Picasso. I mean, Picasso's very latest work is quite terrifying in a sense.
We could actually return to this theme for a dedicated stream on great late works. As we've been talking, another one that springs to mind is Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander, which is it's an amazing film that he made right at the end of his career. But again, it's haunted by the prospect of mortality. But you get this other weird thing that happens with a lot of artists late on. Even Shakespeare has this in his last plays as well, which is a kind of rediscovery of the kind of magic of life as well. I always think of, there's that little scene in Godfather where Vito Corleone's old and he does that little orange trick with a kid. He's just playing in the orchard. Yeah. There's something of that that comes back to an artist when they're older, where they kind of see actually what's actually special in a way. Mm. And I mean, you can certainly see that in Shakespeare's late plays as well. I'm thinking of like Tempest or Winter's Tale or stuff like that. Let's carry on.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these feelings, true, also something that you have to live to discover them. You know, I mean, there are certainly things that myself as a young artist that I know and appreciate now that I was not capable. I just wasn't ready for them. You know, I mean, of course, you're living the life of a younger man, and then of course you live the life of an, you know, increasingly older, and part of this is of course a wisdom, sometimes a painful wisdom, but it certainly comes. And so there are, you know, there's this idea where the entire career of an artist should be digestible, but in a way, a great artist will give you something over the period of years, you know, again, you will come to appreciate things years later if there's something sort of broad enough to follow in their work over your lifetime. And the greatest artists, you know, again, they will provide you secrets, but you can only unlock them as you get there yourself. So that is something that certainly is, I think, a positive thing about this sort of growing older and growing wiser, hopefully. Okay, so this is a painting called Study of a Man Talking from 1981. I think this picture is a good example of this much more spare style that comes in. You know, we saw Bacon transition from the 1950s, which was, you know, very, very sort of monochromatic and dark in many cases for those work, to exploding into color in the late 50s and throughout the 60s and 70s. And you know now there's sort of a kind of, again, a settlement, a kind of almost a kind of elegant emptiness that starts to kind of haunt the works.
Yes, so this is like sort of thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. Yeah, absolutely. And you get this sort of, yeah, you do get a sense of calmness and detachment. And I always wonder, you know, why does this come about? Is this because he knows all the shortcuts now? He knows what works, so he's being more concise. He's probably destroying fewer works because he knows how to get to what he wants to do without making mistakes. He's not overworking. So I wonder, you know, like, why, what exactly it is, what are the mechanics behind this stylistic change? I mean, obviously he sees some exhibitions that push him in this way. One, for example, is he went to see a big exhibition of Ingres, the French neoclassical painter, who was very famous for his sort of very controlled and distance and sort of clinical approach to art. And I think that this influenced Bacon. So while you find someone like Lucian Freud becoming more and more painterly as he grows older, Bacon goes the other way. He becomes more precise, more detached, more reserved.
Okay. All right. So this picture is called Triptych, inspired by the Oresteia of Aeschylus, and it's from 1981. And I think this is quite a significant work from this period. And I wanted to take a moment to talk about it and talk about the inspiration for this. If people may know, of course, the Greek playwright Aeschylus. Just briefly, in case people don't know, the Oresteia is a trilogy. You know, it's three plays, which I think has significance for Francis Bacon, as we know that he was quite fond of the triptych, using the sort of three panels in an interrelationship. And so the Oresteia tells the story of the king of Mycenae, Agamemnon, and that's the first of the three plays. It basically comes home from the Trojan War after 10 years, 10 years away fighting. At the beginning of this conflict, he sacrificed his daughter, basically murdered her, Iphigenia, because he was told that he would not be able to defeat Troy if he did not do this. And it was punishment because I believe that he had hunted, or that he had killed, a stag that was sacred to Artemis, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, so he comes back victorious from the Trojan War, but his wife, meanwhile, whose name is Clytemnestra, of course, has been nursing hatred of him for basically murdering their daughter in order to sort of win glory in the war, and has been planning to kill him, to murder him when he returned. She has taken a lover, whose name I can't remember at the moment, who is a sort of co-conspirator in this plot. And of course, Agamemnon has also taken a concubine called Cassandra. So he returns in glory from battle, with Cassandra, who of course Clytemnestra immediately takes a complete hatred towards. And Cassandra is suddenly sort of hit with this, basically this sort of inner sense of personal dread, this sort of she's sort of struck by prophecy. And people sort of know the idea of, you know, a Cassandra, someone who is telling the truth, but no one will listen to them. And so she immediately sort of prophesies that Agamemnon is in danger and that she and he will both be murdered, which they are. You know, I mean, again, Clytemnestra fulfills her plot to murder her husband, and Clytemnestra takes over, and her lover take over, having killed Cassandra and Agamemnon. So the second of the three plays is called The Libation Bearers, and it involves Orestes, who is the son of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, who comes back to Argos with a plan to murder his mother, Clytemnestra, as revenge for and I believe he was actually ordered by Apollo, the god Apollo, to do this, to kill his mother and her lover as revenge for them murdering Agamemnon. And in the process, when he returns, he goes to his father's grave and he meets his sister, who's called Electra, who has brought libations to her father's grave as a remedy for the kind of Clytemnestra's having all this kind of these kind of tormenting nightmares. And so the idea is that she has brought libations to her father's graves to assuage his wrathful spirit. And she meets her brother there, and I believe a cousin. And they all, Orestes convinces her to join in the plot to exact revenge for their father's murder. So they do it. They carry it out. He goes and he pretends to be a messenger to bring news of the death of Orestes. And so Clytemnestra lets him in, and he proceeds to, with some hesitation, to kill her and to kill her lover. Now, of course, this action of matricide awakens the Furies, who are who are sort of frightful spirits of wrath and vengeance, who then basically are activated, and their only desire is to kill him for this act of matricide. And so you get to the third play, which is called The Eumenides, and he is being chased by the Furies. He is helped by Apollo to escape them. You know, he isn't murdered by them. He's able to, in the nick of time, get away from them. And I believe that he pleads to Athena for help to fully escape their wrath. And so Athena says, "Well, we got to stop all this. You're going to stand trial rather than all this, having the Furies come and tear you apart and continuing this sort of cycle of revenge and murder." And so he is ordered to stand trial in Athens on the Areopagus before 12 Athenian citizens, and he is found that there's a tie in the trial for his matricide, and Athena cast the deciding vote, which is to allow him to live. And the Furies, of course, are very upset about this, but Athena sort of intervenes with them and convinces them, says, you know, we're going to change things now. Now, we're no longer going to resolve things by again, this cycle of revenge and murder. But now your role is to be vigilant for justice. You know, so in other words, instead of being activated to go and slay wrongdoers, you're going to bring them to justice, and we're going to solve things through trials. And so they're sort of transfigured into the Eumenides, from the Furies to the Eumenides. And Eumenides means gracious ones. And so their nature is changed. And sorry for being long-winded about this, but just in case people don't know the story, it's quite fascinating, because again, this is a sort of also could be seen as a kind of progression of the way that man sort of deals with problems from savagery to civilization, you know, from chaos to order, you know, from cycles of revenge to justice. And this is, Bacon, by all accounts, was always quite taken by the Furies. I mean, his first quote official picture, the triptych from 1944, he referred to them as the Furies or Eumenides, those three figures. And of course, he will return to that subject again. But this picture, now, of course, how this picture relates to that story is another matter. We've talked that Bacon is not a narrative painter. This is not a telling of the story. But, you know, he always referred to the Oresteia as a kind of very fertile source of images.
Yes, I think that's a very good summary. He was well known to go back to certain key texts and to sort of read and reread, and he was relatively well read, quite broadly read, but there were certain things that he always went back to, and the Oresteia is one of them.
Yes, and I should pull up this quote because it comes up a lot with Bacon, and he mentions it in interviews. He mentions it on the, if you recall, he was on the South Bank show in 1985. We watched like some clips of that, but he mentions a line from a translation. It's actually Robert Fagel's translation that he was reading. He may not have actually sort of been referring to the work itself, but to another book that kind of explored it, which I've got the title of somewhere here. What is that book? It was called Aeschylus in His Style, A Study in Language and Personality. It was published in 1942, and it's by a man called W.B. Stanford. And that book is probably where Bacon first encountered the Oresteia, and where he got this favorite quote of his from Fagel's translation. So this is one of the Furies who says, "At last, the clear trail of the man, after it silent, but it tracks his guilt to light. He's wounded. Go for the fawn, my hounds. The splash of blood. Hunt him. Rake him down. Oh, the labor, the man-killing labor. My lungs are bursting over the wide rolling earth we've ranged in flock, hurtling the waves in wingless flight. And now we come, all hot pursuit, outracing ships astern, and now he's here, somewhere, cowering like a hare, the reek of human blood, its laughter to my heart." And Bacon loved that line. He sort of paraphrased it often, but he quoted that last line from this translation quite a bit, and said that he wasn't interested in sort of telling the story, but that just so many images were suggested to him by this work.
Yeah, and I would also say note the sort of the deep red color. This will be recurring in some later paintings as well.
Yes, that color sort of becomes it's almost like his color for his base color for the 80s. You know, well, that, and also you see that there is very much of this kind of this kind of combination of kind of neutral light cream color and then a kind of sort of neutral beige color, which he also used quite a lot in works from this period.
Yeah, and I would say that this is a reflection of the way Bacon was a painter of his time, because you remember in the late 60s and 70s we had those sort of purples and really sort of mauves and lilacs and sort of very garish colors. Here we have the sort of the suppressed, the muted tones, the beiges, the sort of the off-whites of the 1980s. So this is the way that decoration was actually entering into Bacon's painting style.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing that sort of always stands out for me is the kind of, you know, it's as if these works are kind of murder in the office in a way. You know, it's sort of interesting how the kind of masses of flesh and the kind of splashes of blood, you know, of the kind of wine dark blood you know, the kind of, you know, multitudinous seas in Carnadine that kind of splash forth into these tastefully neutral spaces. There's a sort of weird kind of 80s, you know, it's like that scene in American Psycho, you know, of the contrast of the sort of sterile order of what's his name, some flat, contrasted with, of course, the splash of blood. I again, it's another one of those films where I wonder how much maybe a subtle influence Francis Bacon's imagery was for that, you know, the kind of sterile whiteness soiled by the blood. And you know, this is absolutely horrific. You know, the, I mean, again, if you go forward, I've got a couple more images of this picture. I mean, first, this is from Christie's. This was when the picture was being sold some number of years ago. And I like this also because it's it gives a sense of the scale of these of many of Bacon's paintings and also their presentation. You can certainly see the gold frames and again the relation of the size of these pictures to, you know, to people, which I think is helpful.
Yeah, and this was a format that he stuck to, basically from the late 50s onwards. Yeah.
And then these are the individual panels. Go through those, and then I've got a couple of even more detailed images. But
Go. And he was, Bacon was known for sort of looking at cookery books. And that he was actually, in a later twist, he was asked to illustrate a couple of cookery books and even a wine label. And he would sometimes look at these cookery books and sort of paint, actually quite directly. He would paint the sort of the chicken carcasses and so forth. And these would become incorporated into the paintings.
Yeah, there's a, and especially with some of the appearances of the Furies in various pictures over the years, they do have sometimes they do take it on a weirdly kind of like a plucked turkey. They have this sort of weird, you know, sort of raw kind of fowl, appearance of a raw fowl. So that's the 81 triptych inspired by the Oresteia. This is called Sand Dune from 1981, and there's actually a number of pictures. He did a sort of number of versions of this subject. I relate these pictures very much to the jet of water that we saw before, and there's another picture which is not being included in these streams of a sink overflowing with water, which I think is a really beautiful painting. But these sort of seemingly, quote, non-objective pictures, you know, where the subject is almost a kind of seemingly neutral feature of the landscape. But we saw that he did pictures like this, you know, much early in his career. You know, there's that landscape at Tangier, I believe, which is sort of, again, this sort of plot of landscape isolated in a way and made the subject. But I think these pictures from the early 1980s are quite interesting. Do you have anything... Yeah.
I would say I would relate these directly to a series of monoprints that Degas made, quite famous ones. Degas was famously not a landscape artist. He really disliked landscapes. He said that gendarmes should be used to drive impressionists out of the landscape, that they were a curse upon the people. But he went on a train journey and he was looking out through the windows, and when he got to the place where he was going, he went straight to the etching press, and he said, you know, give me a plate and I'm going to make some monoplates, some monotypes. And he did these works that were ostensibly views that he had seen, but they were actually more like figure paintings, but they were figures in the form of landscape. So these were sort of halfway between landscape and figure. And this was actually what he exhibited in his only solo exhibition, the Degas solo exhibition during his lifetime, was these very atypical series of prints of landscapes that were just like figures. And these works are very much related to figures. So, of course, you can see there's this sort of like shoulders or buttocks or chests. And the shading of the sand is very similar to the shading of the skin, maybe, you know, like the tanned skin. Bacon was also looking at lots of photographs of bodybuilders and weightlifters and so forth, boxers. So he was looking at a lot of musculature. And these paintings relate very much to that, and the hair, and then the grass, the tufts of grass relating to hair. Mm. And when Bacon was asked about it, he of course completely denied it and said, no, they don't look at all like people. No, I think it's a complete misconception. But of course, this is exactly what he intended. And this was exactly what Degas had done. And Bacon being very canny, he knew Degas' work inside out. I think that these are responses to Degas.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'd not thought about that, the connection to Degas. I mean, also then you could sort of look forward, you know, and one thinks of some of Lucian Freud's, you know, extraordinarily fleshy pictures. You know, of course, famously, there's Benefits Supervisor Sleeping, which is, what is it called, Big Sue?
Yeah,
Big Sue. Sort of enormous fat woman lying nude on a sofa, and you know, it's this sort of expanse of just corpulent flesh. And I think there's I wonder you know, if there was some kind of cross-pollination going on. I mean, this was the sort of period where his friendship with Freud, you know, which had lasted, you know, over 20 years, was sort of drawing to a close.
Well it last started actually during the Second World War, when he used to go out to to East Anglia, because he was friends, I think, with Cedric Morris, and he went out to the school at Dedham, where Lucian Freud was at art school. Even though, of course, people will claim that Lucian Freud never went to art school. Well, that's not what the record shows. Mm. Lucian Freud, not always a trustworthy source. Also Bacon as well, not a trustworthy source.
most artists.
Well, most artists, yes. You know, I must confess I've not always been straightforward. Also, I think it's worth mentioning that people should have a look at the Boyd family, who were vaguely, briefly fashionable in the early 80s. They did this series of works where they took like a sort of little square, you know, like a square meter of like soil or floor or sort of pavement, and they would sort of kind of reproduce it. So they would sort of capture in a strict geometry, and they would put it up on the wall, and it'd be sort of like a sort of raised tableau, a sort of recreation, a replica of this patch of just ground. And they would sort of reproduce, and it would be hung on the wall, so it would be facing you. And I've always got a thought that Bacon doing these little boxes, that he may have been influenced by that. And apparently he was quite friendly with this family group, the Boyds.
The other thing that, of course, that we see as a resurgence is the arrows in these pictures, which we saw, of course, in some of the very early pictures from the late 40s, early 50s, the heads and such. You know, again, these are, I've always thought of these as akin to almost like magician. So if you know about sort of illusionism, magic, one of the key concepts is misdirection. You know, the idea that, of course, that you must master the ability to draw the audience's attention where away from what you're actually doing. You know, you're through various methods, whether subtle or not so subtle, you sort of get them to look where the action isn't happening, so that you can again complete the mechanics of the trick. And in a way, I think we see these arrows, which is again, you'll see an arrow, you see a sign, you see a sort of a direct, you know, a wayfinding system. The arrow has meaning, you know, it has extraordinary symbolic meaning. Of course, Bacon drains that out. The arrows always point to nothing in these pictures. They point to sort of things that we can't see, you know, to point out important things that, of course, are totally unknowable to us.
I would also say that I forgot what I was going to say now. Misdirection. Yeah, so what often happens is that in traditional art, in narrative art, where you've got figures, of course, what you can do is you can tell a story using narrative devices. So you have gestures and you have looks, you have figures looking at something which, you know, directs your eye. In Bacon, of course, he doesn't really do this. He rarely has more than one figure on a painting. So you don't get this sense of being able to read it in a narrative way. So Bacon has to use signs and symbols to sort of direct your attention or to concentrate your focus. So that's where these little arrows come from. And also you've got to remember that Bacon was looking a lot at medical textbooks. He was looking at sports textbooks. So I know that there's more than one author who says that, well, these arrows come from a manual on golfing, and it's quite possible that they did.
Yeah, indeed. But you know, of course, drawn into Bacon's world, they take on a very different meaning. They're sort of drained of their meaning in a way. I want to go on to the next. This is a study by Ingres, the great 19th century French artist. This is a study for one of his pictures called The Turkish Bath, which if people have seen it, it's this acreage of female flesh. So this is a study, I believe this is in the Ingres Museum.
Yes, in Montauban. Which I've never visited. I would love to visit.
No, I've never been there either. Mm. But Bacon had a reproduction of this this study, and of course was quite taken by it for various reasons. You know, again, Ingres is sort of studying the effects of positioning her arms in two very different poses in the same figure, but you get this sort of strange effect of the kind of three-armed nude, you know, the sort of capacious female nude. And this image was used as a sort of inspiration for a number of pictures from this period, including most famously the next one, which is called Diptych, study of the human body, from a drawing by Ingres, I believe that the full title. It's from 1982 to 84.
Yeah, so the diptychs are much less common than the triptychs. Sometimes you find that he mixes stuff around. So there were occasions when he dropped, when he had a set of three and he thinks, well, this doesn't work, so I've got to drop one. And it's usually going to be the central one because the wings are usually matched in some way. They're mirrored in some way formally. So what he often does is he drops the central one and then he's left with two. So this is, you know, where these sorts of things come from. I think it works very well, of course, because here you have the opposition of male and female. So obviously that works extremely well in a diptych. You wouldn't necessarily want to do that in a triptych.
Right. And you also get, you know, again, you know, he's sort of exploring the idea, of course, that, you know, we're so used to bilateral symmetry in our world. I mean, bilateral symmetry is all through biology, including in our own morphology, you know, that we have the sort of mirrored halves. And of course, yes, as Mr. Adams says, it's quite interesting to also use that idea of two mirrored halves to be also the female and the male, but also making these odd equivalencies, you know, between the buttocks and the breasts, you know, between the idea of the sort of testicles and the female knees and the nipples and you know, and of course, and then also the very odd inclusion of the cricket pads in the male figure, you know, and contrasting this sort of headless female with the type, you know, with the letraset transfer type, which, you know, is introducing kind of words that make no sense, you know, letters drained of their meaning as words. So I think there's a lot of quite curious and interesting things going on in this diptych particularly.
Yeah, and he's actually quite a sensitive painter of flesh, because you see he's been quite careful with his shading, Now, you remember earlier on, he's doing lots of things where you can see the brushwork, where you can see the way the paint has been applied. You can see the speed. You can perhaps sometimes see the mistakes. You can see the splatter. All that's gone. So he's been looking at Angra a lot, and he started to shade. He started to sort of dab the paintbrush, which gives you a sort of gentle graduated form. He sort of builds, he models. And yet, of course, these are impossible forms. He never actually suggests to you that these could be real forms in the way that Salvador Dali would paint a picture where you had this weird creature that was actually realistic. But this is quite an interesting compromise where it's sort of painterly, but, you know, he is actually quite good at describing these forms as volumetric.
Okay, this is painting 1980, painting March 1985, and this is sort of an interesting combination of what we saw in the sand dune pictures, what we saw in the sort of pictures of water, you know, with one of these sort of figures slipping out of Cartesian space in a way. I find these pictures quite interesting, but this is a sort of interesting synthesis of the quote sort of non-objective landscape pictures, and then of course the pictures populated by these sort of flesh monsters of one sort or the other.
The origin of the D octopus revealed.
Yeah, I was going to mention there is a very octopus poid quality to that thing. Okay. This is a study for a self-portrait triptych 1985-1986. And I think this is a very important picture. In fact, probably one of the more sort of important, well-known pictures of Bacon's late period. And certainly a late settlement of, you know, because we know from the previous streams that he had done self-portraits, you know, throughout much of his career. And so I think that this is a change of tack, a change of form. Again, we see this late spareness, you know, this late sort of kind of emptiness. And, you know, the figures in each of the picture are much kind of smaller than they generally were in the past. It's a much more kind of isolated figure, in space. It's also not hidden, you know, that there's nothing sort of, he's not lurking behind something as often you see figures in the earlier works, you know, he's sort of placing himself right there, almost vulnerable in a way that perhaps we didn't see in earlier sort of manifestations of the self-portrait.
Yeah, I would say that this is Bacon consciously trying to position himself. I mean, obviously he's framing himself. This is the way he wants to be seen. And I think that this is him thinking of himself in terms of the grand masters, in the old masters, you know, the Velasquez and Titian and Angra. We should also point out that this was also 85 was a big year for Bacon, because that was the year of his second Tate retrospective, which was held in 1985. It ran from May to August in 1985. I think as a child, actually, we went to the Tate, and I think we were kind of warned away from going into the Francis Bacon exhibition, which I think when I, you know, was sort of perhaps not even a teenager at the time. So it was probably maybe a wise thing. The exhibition went from London to Stuttgart to Berlin, and no one died at the opening. So you remember that Peter Lacy died in 62 at the opening of the Tate. Dyer died at the opening of the Grand Palais retrospective in 71. There were no dramatic deaths in 1985. John Edwards was very much alive, and so was Francis Bacon. And we should also say that Bacon, by this time, of course, was even more in control of his career than he had been. He was, quite rightly, artists are very controlling about what people see about their art during, especially during their lifetimes. And Bacon's second retrospective was criticized, I think, because they said, oh, you haven't got anything before 1944, because remember, he had done some paintings in the 30s and early 40s, but these were completely erased from the canon. You couldn't even show these anymore. So Bacon was just like, no, everything starts in 44 and that's it. And also there was a high number of late paintings from the 70s and 80s, which the critics were not so keen on. So obviously that's something they criticized him for. But, I mean, it's quite reasonable for him to say, you saw lots of the early pictures in 62. We're now in 85. I've done quite a lot of work since then. I think people want to see the later work. There was also the possibility that the Marlborough, being very canny operators, were promoting the late work because they actually owned it. And so they were raising its profile in order to sell it on at a greater price.
Mm. Yes.
So okay, this is the
87
triptych, isn't it?
Yeah. Triptych 86-87. So this is curious because, of course, we see the return in this of the kind of historical figure. So the figure on the left was inspired by a photograph of the American president Woodrow Wilson. And also,
I'd say he looks quite a lot like Woodrow Wilson. So,
yes.
Bacon is at least good enough at painting to let me recognize him.
Yeah. So that was the source of the figure on the left. I believe also that there was a picture of Trotsky that had played some part in this, or it was some sort of inspiration, perhaps for the third panel.
That's the desk where he was murdered.
Is that that's Trotsky's death?
That's from a photograph, a documentary photograph of the crime scene where Trotsky was murdered in, what was it, 38 or something?
I was thinking it was the penis, but it's just me.
You recognise the penis? Oh, okay.
No, I was thinking, that Trotsky indeed was a penis. Political guy. I really don't like Trotsky very much, but carry on.
Nor Woodrow Wilson, for that matter. Certainly, both very charged figures for the history of the 20th century, I would say.
You know, there's that whole Hannah Arendt thing that fascism and communism are two sides of the same coin. That is a nonsensical thesis, of course, pushed by the CIA. But a much truer thesis is that Woodrow Wilson and Trotsky were indeed two sides of exactly the same coin. I would stand by that thesis a lot more. But carry on.
And then, of course, we have in the center panel, we have what's obviously John Edwards, the likeness of John Edwards, grafted to a degree onto that figure we saw early in Studies for the Human Body. You know, we see the same sort of the cricket pads, the same sort of, arrangement of the figure, the genitals, but, sort of now personified, given a head, given a face. So there's a very interesting picture. Certainly claimed never to do narrative, but there is certainly a suggestion of relationships between the figures here. You're all right. We lost the image.
No. It's gone, come back, and now we're sort of in a small screen mode or something.
Mm.
I agree that this is unusually specific and explicit for Bacon. Yeah, as you say, he doesn't really want to be tied down on sources, but of course anyone who's got any historical knowledge at all will have recognised Wilson, and a lot of people will have recognised Trotsky's desk. It's odd that he's using such obvious sources, and you'd think, if he wants to avoid narrative explanations or at least narrative interpretations, what's he doing using such obvious sources?
Yeah. Hey, are you still with us?
Yes.
Oh, okay. We can't see anything now.
Oh no no, I can see it.
Well, I just see the background, but I don't see the picture. I don't see the painting anymore.
Okay, well, I think something went.
I think something went wrong on your end, D, because your avatar disappeared.
Okay, let me go out and come in again.
Okay, so I will talk. So this is one of the late period paintings. So we have a return to black. So black, which sort of featured a little bit in the 70s, comes back. But again, you've got that sort of taupe colour. There is a mixture of, well, yeah, in these paintings, this is sort of like a canvas colour paint. So this isn't actually the canvas, but he sometimes uses canvas colour paint. So he wants to use bare canvas, bare linen, which has a sort of, you know, sort of a fawn colour. Sometimes he makes a mistake and he needs to go over it. But of course, you can't recapture the bare canvas. You can't wipe it clean. Once you've applied the paint, there's just no getting the paint out. So you would have to paint over it in a colour that's equivalent to the colour of flax or linen. And this is, I don't know that this is what's happened in this case, but it has obviously happened in the other cases. There are situations where you see paintings and you're like, oh yeah, he made a mistake, so he had to paint that over. Here, it does seem as though he did intend to do this from the beginning.
Yes. Also, I found the source pictures. And so the picture of Wilson was taken from an image of Wilson leaving the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919, and the image of Trotsky, yes, it is a very direct quotation of a standing desk. Yes, the room in Mexico City where Trotsky was attacked on the 20th of August 1940. So very explicit references to these two figures.
Yeah. Oh, did you know that there was a Mexican muralist who tried to assassinate Trotsky?
Yes. I can't remember who it was.
It wasn't Sicoras.
It was certainly not Diego Rivera, but
no, it was the
wonder
third,
who it was.
Yeah, the third Musketeer. Yeah, so anyway, he went there and, well, I know, actually, I should read up about it before trying to recount the anecdote. Mm. He was the communists in Mexico, where Trotsky was at this time, were very pro-Stalin. They were completely on board with this, with the Stalin position, and anti-Trotsky. And so that even to the extent of actually trying to break into his house and trying to murder him.
Okay. So if you could talk about this, the next picture for a while, I'm going, oh, there we go. Now I'm getting the image back again. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So this is, lots of people will recognize this. This is the second version of, the famous triptych, which he did in 44 to 45, the orange one, which you'll remember went to the Tate and basically kickstarted his career. This was painted in, so was this 88.
It was always remember, of course, 44 or 88. And it's also owned by the Tate, this picture.
Yes, it came to be owned by the Tate. It was, I thought this was made specifically for the, yeah, so this was made for the Hirshhorn exhibition. Yeah. In that's a big contemporary art or modern art gallery in Washington DC. Well, yes.
which I saw. So this the exhibition was quite meaningful to me because I actually visited it, and I still have the catalog which I purchased at the time. So yeah.
So also we have to remember that this is well, we might as well talk about it now. So this was when his work went to Moscow. He was offered a solo exhibition in Moscow in 1988, which was a very big deal at the time. The USSR still existed. It was still a communist country. Western art was pretty much banned. Avant-garde art was either banned or it was not. You couldn't publicly exhibit it. I remember there was a case in the woods. There was a contemporary exhibition of avant-garde art out made by Russian artists out in the woods outside Moscow because they couldn't get a venue. The authorities weren't terribly keen on it. They hired some bulldozers and basically ran it into the ground. So that was the Russian attitude, the Soviet attitude towards contemporary art. And I know it's probably the view of some of our listeners as well. But Bacon was offered this chance. This was arranged by a young gallerist called James Birch. I do urge you to get a copy if you're interested of Bacon in Moscow, a recent book by James Birch. And he explains the back story to this much better than I could. But essentially, he had a whole bunch of artists and he wanted to take them over to Moscow. But in return, you know, he would have to bring some Russian artists back to London because he was a London gallerist. He was speaking to his fixer over in Moscow and the guy was kind of like unimpressed with the artists he wanted to bring over. And he said, well, do you know anyone big? And James Birch said, well, the biggest artist I know is Francis Bacon, because James Birch actually had been babysat by Francis Bacon, who was actually very good with children, although he didn't actually spend much time with them. He didn't like them much, but he seems to be quite good with them when he did encounter them. So James Birch was sort of like the honorary godson, unofficial godson of Francis Bacon. Birch had already sort of cut his teeth as a gallerist. So when he approached Bacon, Bacon was kind of thrilled, because you'll remember that Bacon was very interested in Eisenstein's films. He was excited by photographs of the October Revolution. He liked the character and the excitement of the Russian Revolution, which happened when he was young. So he sort of equated it with sort of youthfulness and seismic changes and the outbreak of brutality in everyday life. So the chance of exhibiting in Moscow was extremely alluring to him. He went along with it, he agreed. And basically, to cut a long story short, Birch took, I think it's about sort of 15 paintings, maybe 20 paintings by Bacon over to the artist's house in Moscow. And it caused a sensation, because the only things of Bacon's that they'd ever seen were just sort of small black and white reproductions. And so suddenly to come across these pictures, big pictures, mind you, strong colour, very tactile, very sensuous, it created a massive impression amongst Russian artists and Russian visitors. And this was pretty much done by Birch on his own with the assistance of various Russians. This was not sponsored by the British state. The Arts Council, the British Council, which is basically the foreign diplomatic section of the Arts Council, wanted to get involved. Bacon said, oh, if you get involved, then I'll have to go to all these boring meetings. I'll have to go to all these dinners and stuff. I don't want to do that. And so he, in the end, gave his permission for the exhibition, but he didn't want to go over himself. Initially, he had been quite excited to visit Moscow. Turns out that one of the reasons why he didn't go to Moscow was that David Sylvester, the critic who had done all the interviews with him and had been very formative in explaining Bacon, had words with, he didn't see eye to eye with either John Edwards or James Birch. And he whispered in Bacon's ear, if you go over, you could be kidnapped, because we all know about the Russian mafia, which was sort of around at this time. So don't go, your life could be in danger. And that was apparently what tipped Bacon over into not visiting his historic solo exhibition in Moscow in 88.
Bit greatest hits though, isn't it?
Yes. Well, he couldn't take over certain pictures. This picture actually didn't go over. So I got this wrong. This was painted the same year, but it didn't go over. This went to the American show.
Yeah.
But Bacon had already had a habit of repainting, doing new versions of pictures for pictures which couldn't travel. So yeah, this was actually a greatest hits.
But it's a significantly, I mean, again, if you compare them, it's a significantly different picture and has a very different effect. I mean, certainly just on the basis of the kind of the figures are more, they're smaller. Again, we as with that self-portrait triptych that we looked at a bit ago, the figures are kind of smaller in the space of the works, more isolated. And of course, this, again, this sort of dark red color, it just has a very different feeling to it, certainly when you see them in person as well. So I wouldn't say that this is really just a kind of total rehash of that picture, of the 1944 picture. It's very different.
Yeah, so obviously it's a quotation. It's been much adapted. It has a different feel. The coloration is different. He's, in a way, you think maybe this picture has suffered because he's had to sort of crank it up to his normal format. So he's done here his normal format, which is the which is 198 centimeters by 147 centimeters. That's 78 by 58 inches. And he's had to move it up to this standard size. And I think that the picture has kind of suffered from that. If you remember the other one, it's orange, it's smaller. The figures are much larger in comparison to the surface of the picture. It feels much more claustrophobic. It's quite raw, quite powerful. Here, of course, it's a little bit more detached. It's like looking at these things through, they're in a sort of like in a zoo or in a viewing room. So it's like you're sort of seeing them from a distance, of course, because quite literally they are just smaller compared to the overall size of the pictures.
And if you go on there, I've got sort of the individual panels, perhaps it'd be even better, but... So I think we could watch that short video now as we sort of go into the 1990s.
Started to paint. I never, for instance, expected anybody to ever buy my work. I always thought that I would have to do some other kind of job to earn my living. So that gradually, as I've been lucky enough to sell painting and have been able to live by my work, I think I still have the same indifference to what other people think about it. When I first started to work, I worked to excite myself. Now, as it happens, that other people become slightly interested in it. And so sometimes I sell things. My things are always difficult to sell, but every so often they do sell some.
Your ideas about life, about society, and so forth, were they formed at an early time in your life, or did you go through periods when you thought quite other things?
Well, when I was young, I thought nothing except enjoying myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really think about that. I suppose that later you could say my philosophy, you wouldn't call it a philosophy. I think life, in a way, is so difficult that you may as well be as decent as you possibly can be, or as indulgent as you possibly can towards other people, hoping they'll behave in the same way to you. It doesn't necessarily work out that way, but that's how it comes about. So, I mean, I haven't got a very coherent philosophy of life. But philosophy, what is it to me? Nothing, because after all, I'm perfect from my own point of view. I know we're born and we die, and that's it. And you do something in between if you can, or if you want to.
It's often said about you that your work reflects a feeling of disgust about human beings and or self-disgust.
Well, I don't really know. People, perhaps they feel that my work is full of mortality, but then we are. I mean, that is what life is. That's what life is. I mean, we are born, we exist for a moment, and we do with our life what we can, and then we die. And what else can you? What else is there? And if somebody is very aware of that, perhaps it comes out in their work. I certainly don't try to press that side in my work at all. I think it's just very straightforward.
So there we go. We hear the sort of reiteration of his sort of nihilist slash existentialist philosophy. I always think that's quite interesting at the end, because you've got George Dyer and William Blake looking over his shoulder on the top of the cabinet there behind the sofa.
Sounds like Macbeth. Very much end of Macbeth vibes, you know, out with candle, you know, life is a tale told by an idiot, etc.
Sound and fury and signifying nothing.
Yeah.
Oh dear. You know, again, who knows? He says that, of course, that isn't a concern, but I cannot sort of look at these, you know, I mean, all of his work in a way, but certainly these late works, and not also think about that, you know, this was something on his mind. You know, his sort of physical powers were fading. I mean, he, you know, from the beginning of the 1990s, you know, he was quite ill, you know, and had significant health problems. So
remember, he has very serious asthma. He's taking all sorts of medication to help him sleep. He has difficulty sleeping, so he's having to take stuff to get him off to sleep, but often these are interfering with his breathing, which of course is exacerbating his asthma. And so, you know, he obviously had very many long nights where he was sort of, he was juggling the dosage of various prescriptions, plus of course drinking very heavily. Which
he also had, I didn't know, but he had kidney cancer. He had a cancerous kidney, and it was removed. I don't know. It was around the late 1980s or maybe the early 90s when this happened, but I hadn't known about that previously. So.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. I thought that was actually in the late 70s. But
it could have been. Yeah. I don't know the details. I thought it was later.
Yeah, I think so. And so he was being treated for various health conditions, and obviously he was getting older by this time. So he was born in 1909. So by 1989, he turned 80, and he had slowed down a lot, and people had noticed that he was obviously aging and that he wasn't drinking as much as he used to. And there's something of a painful interview of him with Daniel Farson, recorded in 91 or something, which shows Bacon sort of not in a particularly good light. He's quite drunk, but in the Bragg interview in the sort of mid 80s, he's in very fine form. But that second interview from the 1990s is yes.
The one we just watched was from 1980. From 1987, I believe.
Yeah. Where he's speaking to David Sylvester, who I just mentioned.
Yeah, yes. Okay. This picture, I actually originally thought it was from this period, at the late 80s, but it's actually from 1984. But of course it shows, shows Bacon, showing his age, you know, obviously. Mm.
So this is Richard Avedon, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. We should mention. So at this time, his relationship with John Edwards is kind of like sort of father son, sort of adoptive son or helper or assistant.
Yeah.
And he meets someone called Jose Capello, who's a Spanish banker, very much alive. So, you know, I'm going to be polite about him.
Yeah,
no reason not to be polite about him, because, you know, I don't know anything. You know.
Yeah, I've got a picture of him in a few slides. But,
oh, okay, right, okay. We'll leave it till then. But this is 89 or something?
91. Studies in the human body. Yeah,
this is one of the very last paintings, apparently based on a photographs of a dancer friend of the artist.
This picture always strikes me for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, we sort of get the, you know, if you remember some of the earliest pictures, they were very sparsely painted. You know, most of the surface of the painting was sort of, you know, just the un the untouched canvas. I mean, you can see, in fact, most of this surface of this, or at least a lot of the surface of this, is just the back of the linen, you know, with no color applied to it at all. It's but also that this figure who's sort of almost embedded in the ground, almost half in or half out of the grave, is how this always struck me. Again, and you know, in retrospect, it's easy. I mean, after an artist dies, it's easy to sort of perhaps see a prophetic sense in their late work. And I don't know if that's exactly true, but it's certainly how it strikes me, you know, the sort of the head, you know, trapped in an ever smaller box, and you know, and the body again, either descending or ascending from the grave.
I hate to be crass, but we've talked about the meaninglessness of the arrow quite a few times. This particular arrow strikes me as less meaningless than some of the others.
Yes, well, I think the homoerotic quality is something I'm not qualified to speak on.
The arrow is you know, the arrow is pointing at the hip, you know, where the femoral process would be. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not really pointing at the genitals. So I don't know. I think of it as more orthopedic than you know, and of course his legs are doing some quite interesting contortions. So I've always thought of it more kind of pointing at the hip bone. But your mileage may vary, as they say.
No, come on, D. This is prime territory. I think this is the full homo. Bacon was quite open about. And he didn't discuss it very much in interviews, but he was, you know, he's quite open in private about that, you know, that he had certain types of men that he was attracted to, and that there were certain physical forms that he liked: muscular men, he liked older men, he liked manual workers and so forth. He also, it's quite an interesting passage. He did this whole series of interviews with David Sylvester, which was published as The Brutality of Fact. And then there was a later book which came out, which was a series of not always terribly revealing snippets that were cut from those interviews, but were sort of collected in a second book, which was published by David Sylvester right at the end of his life. And it was full of these little observations. And one of the observations was that he really liked close cropped hair because it showed the shape of the head and the skull and the neck, and that this was something that appealed to him greatly. Because I remember he was asked to paint Allen Ginsberg when they met in Tangiers in the early 1960s, and Bacon said that he wasn't really into that sort of thing was because, you know, of course, Allen Ginsberg, famous for having, you know, very long hair and a giant bushy beard and so forth, and Bacon really didn't like that. So it's quite interesting that he had his particular preferences.
Don't we all? Yeah. Okay, you want to go to the next? And these are all, yes, amongst the very last pictures that Bacon completed, you know. We again see it sort of revisiting of a form. Here, that odd sort of tripod object that sort of appears in various pictures, including in both of the, you know, in the 44 and 88 triptych, the figure again dissolving into the blackness of the open door. Well, you know, a lot of the pictures from the 90s, the very last ones, I mean, they all seem slightly unfinished in a way. Forgive me, if you want to go on,
I'll carry on, I'll step in. Yeah, so they seem very sparse, and they perhaps, yeah, as Mr. D said, perhaps a little bit too sparse, that they feel a little bit incomplete. I think that this is they're not actually incomplete. I mean, Bacon signed all these works. They all left the studio. They all went to the gallery, and they were sold and so forth. So they're not actually unfinished works. I think that there was one unfinished work in the studio at the time of his death. But yeah, so you see this great simplification. Now, Bacon didn't usually do commissions. I don't think this was a commission, but there was actually a commission, quite an interesting commission, of portrait of Gilbert de Botton, father of Alain de Botton. Gilbert de Botton was a Swiss banker, I believe, and it's actually a very good portrait. But Bacon didn't need to do portraits because he had plenty of money. He could just do portraits of his friends, of people who interested him, because he wasn't a sort of society portraitist. But it's quite interesting that he did do that de Botton painting in the 1980s when he had no need to do it. So, yeah. Also, you see the orange here coming in. Yeah, the orange coming in, which we've seen before.
Yep. And hello. Sorry.
Yes, Mr. D, this one's for you.
So this is Francis Bacon's final completed work, which is called Study of a Bull, 1991. And I think that, you know, this picture, more than any of the others, I mean, seems sort of, again, a very different type of painting. And also, in a way, again, it's that sense that one gets, of course, the absolute resonance of this picture, given the fact that it's the last picture that he ever painted. Of this sort of spectral bull, you know, again, passing through portals, passing from darkness to light, or from light to darkness, you know, that painted in this sort of very limited palette. And of course, the figure of the bull in relation to, you know, we saw the bullfighting pictures from the 1960s, but I think also the bull as a kind of there were of course a couple of other even earlier pictures of with bulls in them. So, but I think again a very sort of resonant figure for Bacon. I mean, certainly also with his relationship with Picasso, you know. But you know the Minotaur in the maze. So I've always been sort of struck. I mean, since I first saw this picture, I've always been kind of struck by it so much. It seems to be this sort of again, in retrospect, this sort of image of passing on or passing away or a transformation.
Mm. Yeah. So sort of it's on the threshold, and by this time Bacon was very seriously ill, that he'd had some he was being advised not to travel and so forth. He had an oxygen cylinder with him at home just to help him get through the night and so forth. This painting, you think, well, he probably thought that he probably knew that his time was very, very short indeed. Although you'll know, well, we'll say when it comes to it, when he dies, but this is actually painted about a year before he dies. So, and he's not doing very much in between this and his last, the very last unfinished painting, which I don't know if we're going to see, but this was included, was Dust. You remember that there was a 45 or 46 painting, which included Dust, on the depiction of the suit. Here you have some of the dust being used for the body of the bull, and of course dust to dust, ashes to ashes. So yeah, the question of mortality was much on his mind.
Yes, and also someone mentions in the chat, but also yes, I mean the sort of significance of the animal and the sort of shadow of the animal in its relation to some of the very earliest images created by man in the form of, you know, prehistoric cave mm-hmm. art and such, which interestingly some of them were produced by kind of blowing pigments, you know, blowing ashes, blowing charcoal onto, you know, onto the walls, and forming these sort of, again, shadow animals. And so I get a touch of that with this this picture. But I as far as I know, this is the final quote unquote completed picture. There was another that he was working on that actually is visible in some of the last slides I have whilst it was still in the studio. But so if you want to go to the next image, so this is the fellow that Mr. Adams was talking about in the next picture, Jose Capello. Now, I'm very interested in the relationship because, of course, I have read comments by Mr. Capello who denied that he ever had a relationship with Francis Bacon. I mean, they certainly had some sort of friendship, some sort of interrelationship, because of course Bacon famously, you know, he visited him in Madrid prior to 1992. And it's also known that he owned quite a number of Francis Bacon pictures, which actually come up in a news story, you know, that maybe we can mention later on in terms of art theft. But I'm not exactly sure the nature of their relationship. As we said, that his Bacon's sort of friendship with Edwards was very much kind of paternal, and Edwards lived elsewhere, and Edwards lived with had a male you know, boyfriend, partner, whatever you call it. So you know, as with other relationships in Bacon's past, he continued to sort of have dalliances with other people. But you know, again, I think he was, you know, Bacon was so old and so infirm. Whether this newer relationship with this Spaniard had any sort of physical component, but certainly he. This man, the Capello, denies it, so I don't know.
Yeah, so yeah, we'll just say sort of read the books, read the interviews, and so forth. There's disputes over sort of what exactly the nature of that friendship was, and Bacon did some portraits of Capello, not, I'm afraid, very good paintings. He was included in the last triptych, which. And then, but unfortunately, Capello said, "Well, I'm a little bit too recognizable in that, Francis. Could you paint me out?" And so Bacon painted over his face and replaced it with a portrait of Ayrton Senna, which is actually not, he doesn't look completely dissimilar to Ayrton Senna.
Mm.
Yeah. I think he looks quite a lot like Jamie Theakston. I don't know if you remember Jamie Theakston, but
yeah.
Yeah, he really does look quite a lot of Jamie Theakston. Yeah. So.
I can see it. Yeah, I can see it.
And so, yeah, so Bacon was, this was interesting for Bacon because, of course, he talked in terms of love or in terms of passion. So Bacon certainly thought of it in terms of, in romantic terms. But beyond that, I can't say. But he made a point of visiting Madrid in sort of 89, 90, 91, and 92. Madrid was where Capello was based. Bacon liked visiting Madrid, not least because of the Prado. He didn't go to as many museums as you might expect because he liked to look at art through reproductions.
Yeah.
I think he felt less intimidated by seeing works in reproduction, especially if he was going to do versions of them. But he did go to the Prado, which, of course, is home to the most fantastic collection of paintings by Velázquez, one of his heroes, who painted the portrait of Pope Innocent X, which is not in Madrid.
No, in Italy. although Bacon did go to, as far as I know, he did visit a major Velázquez retrospective, and I don't know if that picture was included. He claimed to have never seen it in person, but I don't know. Maybe he saw it then. I don't know if it was in that exhibition.
Well, he may have claimed not to have seen it up to that point, and then later on he did see it, maybe.
Right, okay. So if you want to go to the next image, this is actually one of the last, and maybe the last picture of Francis Bacon taken in Madrid in 1992 on that fateful trip. In fact, this was when I found it. It's titled "The Last Martini." So, Bacon, against the advice of his doctors, went to Madrid and became quite ill. I mean, he was quite ill basically by the time he got there, and he was admitted to a private clinic which was run by the a Catholic organization called the Handmaids of Moriah. And he died of a heart attack on the 28th of April, 1992, under the care of these nuns in this clinic. So, so this was his last fateful trip.
Yes, I remember hearing about this. I was actually at life class. I was at art college at the time, and as you know, that's like the word started getting out that Francis Bacon had died, and it was quite a big thing, because even if you weren't a fan of his work, you knew of him as a very important painter. So it was sort of made a strong impression on me. And I remember the next day I went out and bought copies of the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian, the Independent, and so forth, just to collect the obituaries, because of course this was before the internet. So this was how you. So, and of course, they had the big sort of splash pages and so forth. They had very long obituaries. And of course, what happens is that these obituaries of famous people and sort of so forth. And you might remember this from the time when Bowie died, that they have all this material ready to go when the person dies. So it wasn't a case of, you know, they had to scramble to get someone to write a 5,000 word article. These articles were already in the files, waiting to go, and so the following day you could pick up a newspaper and there were these lengthy profiles. Oh, and by the way, he was cremated, and his ashes were scattered in a place which has not been revealed, apparently.
Stay on this one for a moment. So it turns out that his sole heir was John Edwards, who we've discussed quite a bit. The sole heir of his estate, I believe, his estate at his death was valued at £11 million, which, given of course what became of his prices, in subsequent years, seems a very small amount. There were quite a lot of legal matters that were settled in the subsequent years between the estate and Marlborough Gallery, but yes, John Edwards was the sole heir, and I believe that another friend of Bacon called Brian Clark was the executor of the estate, or perhaps Edwards named him as the executor of the estate to take care of the business rather than Edwards. But it took quite a number of years to sort of bring any settlement to the estate. And in the meantime, Bacon's studio and flat remained, untouched and intact. And indeed, the final images that I have here are photographs of Bacon's studio and the flat as well, that were taken in 1998, just prior to their dismantling. So in 98, the estate bequeathed the contents of the studio to the Hugh Lane in Dublin, for various reasons. I think we touched on this in a previous stream.
Yeah, so someone in the questions, in the chat, is asking, there was no surviving family. There was Ianthe, his sister. So he had two brothers who had died, and he had, I think, two sisters, and one, at least one of them, was alive. And he was on quite friendly terms with them, and he paid for like sort of expensive private medical bills for various members of his family and also for close friends. So he was extremely generous during his life. I think there's a lot of people who you might expect to have been named in the will were not named, because Bacon had been extremely generous with money and giving away very valuable pictures. So I think he felt like he'd done that. He'd paid his dues already, and he wanted to keep it simple. So everything went to John Edwards.
Yes. And of course, I don't know a lot of the dispensation of course, Marlborough had possession of probably quite a number of pictures, and as I said, that was litigated. I don't know a lot of the details about.
Well,
this.
I can tell you very briefly. So this is a summary. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying. AA keeps trying to go ahead. Don't go ahead yet. Stay here.
Yeah. So there was a, when was this case? So this was about 2001, 2002. There was a case between the Bacon estate, which by this time had gone over to Clark, I believe, because John Edwards sadly did not live terribly long after Bacon died. He died of cancer, actually. But anyway, the Bacon estate in around 2000 set out to sue the Marlborough Gallery, which is actually a huge international organization with branches all over the world, including Liechtenstein and Switzerland, for £100 million. And it got very close to litigation and was called off at the last moment. And there was a private agreement, which the contents of which have not been disclosed, but it was called off at the last moment. So, and they were suggesting that there had been mismanagement of funds and not had been, the proper accounting procedures had not been followed. So, yeah, so it was basically, it was a little bit messy at the end.
Yeah.
Although this is after Bacon has died.
Yeah, quite, you know, almost a decade afterwards. So, so this is the exterior of 7 Rees-Mews, where Bacon lived and worked since the early 1960s. This is it looks very different today, but this is how it basically appeared during Bacon's life. This was taken in the mid late 90s, but it's you know, very, it's in South Kensington. It's very near the Natural History Museum, you know, again, quite a non-prepossessing exterior. So if you want to,
yeah, so this is a mews building. It was, I think, originally a stable, so a mews, a small, it's like a sort of essentially a sort of a spur. It's a sort of cul-de-sac which just comes off in this case it was a high street, and it's there's no through traffic and so forth. And Bacon lived at the top floor, and the bottom floor that you can see is sort of like, you've got a grey door, and then you've got you've got a garage area. That was originally the stables area, and that was apparently full of bags of documents, papers, painting materials, old canvases and stuff. And he used to use the top floor.
Okay. And this is, you know, so when you went in the door, there was a set of very narrow stairs. And at the top of the stairs, of course, is the door to Bacon's studio where he worked. On the other side, of course, is the rest of the flat. I have one picture of that as well at the end. You also saw a bit of it in that interview with David Sylvester, that green sofa. That's actually the sort of lounge area of the was the lounge area of the flat. Okay. So this is the studio as Bacon left it in 1992, and we've seen a bit of this famously chaotic space in other images and videos that we watched in previous editions of the stream. So, but this gives you a sense of the kind of scope and scale of the materials inside. So as I said, the contents of the studio were given to the Hugh Lane in Dublin, and over the course of many months, perhaps even longer, there was they made a sort of survey, including basically sort of having various conservation scientists and such sort of assess and catalogue every single item, every scrap of paper, every dried up paintbrush, every eviscerated paint tube, every canvas, some of which was slashed, you know, every book, whatever. This is all cataloged. The position of everything was very carefully mapped, you know, and then the studio was moved, including the, you know, including the walls and the ceiling and all of that. It was moved to the Hugh Lane and reconstructed, and everything was put back more or less where it had been. So it's a massive undertaking that this bit of almost archaeology excavation. You want to go on? You can see more.
Yeah. By the way, the position you've got there is you're basically looking from where the window. There was a window that was covered over that Bacon never used because he only ever used the skylight or the electric light. But the window where you're standing at the back, which is your back here again. This is just like a different view. In the Hugh Lane, I believe that is where there is like a glass partition, yeah. And you can look through into the studio as if you were basically looking through the window.
Yeah, and that is where most of the paintings, most of the canvases, that's where he placed the canvases when he worked on them. So you can see the sort of position of that easel. I mean, it's sort of where that window would have been, where most of the time he either had the canvas on an easel or it was propped up there.
Yeah, and he could only work on one canvas at a time, one large canvas at a time.
Yeah, it's a fairly small space.
Oh, sorry, no, I just have to explain. The window at the back was covered over by other canvases and by any canvas he was working on the easel. He only used the skylight and the electric light.
Yes. And there's the wall, which he called his only abstract paintings. And of course, he quite rightfully said also photographers like to pose him in front of those walls to take pictures of him. This is let me just see if this is the one. Yeah, this is actually quite an earlier picture. This was actually taken by Lord Snowden, famously the photographer. This was from the 70s. You can see actually Francis Bacon's glass perched there, but I put it in as a I quite like this picture, but this is all the rest of from, you know, after his death. So
yeah, he used a mixture of art materials that he would buy from his local store. He used also sort of other materials that were not standard artist materials, so like the letraset, the dry lettering. He would also use foam rollers to apply paint, so sometimes he would use emulsion as well, oil paint, acrylic paint, pastels to fill in large areas. He never did the figures in pastel.
Okay. And, you know, the floor of the space was just an ocean of basically clippings, books, reference materials. You know, you can see some of there's a book on Avard Munch, you know, there's you know, pictures of Bacon, there's some pictures of his own work.
That's a Rodin sculpture photograph. Yeah, you can also see the spray cans there that he was using a lot in his last years. So these were just like normal aerosol cans that you would use to spray cars and so forth, and the rollers. Book on Velázquez.
Oh, I had myself muted. Sorry about that.
Lucian Freud photograph on the top right. Taken by John Deacon.
Yeah. And, you know, again, all the sort of art books, various things. Yeah, there's the foam rollers. Yeah. And that's in the lounge that we saw. There is the there's the life mask of William Blake, which someone gave him, which he kept, and photographs of various people. John Edwards next to it. That's the colony room. On the left at the edge of the cabinet, you know, you see Peter Lacy, Dyer, various people.
Interestingly enough, just at the time when he died, so we've spoken about the fact he had a flat in Paris during the 1970s, very small, which he spent quite a bit of time in, but he didn't paint so much there. He was also thinking, apparently, at the time of his death, of getting a flat in Monaco. So he's thinking of going back to Monte Carlo and having a small place there so he could sort of gamble and be by the sea. He'd been recommended to spend more time in the south of France because of his asthma. So I think that the Monte Carlo thing would have taken him back to the 1940s, allowed him to gamble, but also have been sort of slightly kinder on his lungs.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to the next one.
Oh, someone's asking about the original Death Mask. No, that's not the original Death Mask. That's one of the casts of...
Yes.
There were multiple casts. You'll find that for famous figures, there were often multiple casts of figures. And also, I think we mentioned that Bacon also had his life mask cast.
I like these last two pictures because, you know, I just like the idea of seeing Francis Bacon's cooker. So so there you go. Selection of sauces and jams. but interesting, of course, you can sort of see also, we saw a bit of this in a video, that he liked to have reproductions of his own work, that he'd sort of change this changing sort of assemblage of pictures, of paintings, many sort of paintings that he had recently been working on. You know, all of these, you know, of paintings from, you know, you can see them from the, most of them from the 80s. Interesting, I forgot to mention that you see the picture of the man sort of adjusting his tie in before what seems to be a mirror. That is Gilbert de Botton, who was one of Bacon's sort of patrons in the 80s. He bought a lot of Bacon's work and commissioned a portrait of himself, which that's it. I don't know if he's related to that Amber, yes, the de Botton.
Oh yeah, I think he might be. Yes, I think maybe he's the. Yeah,
it was just family. Reshuffled by Sunak, but yeah, so there we go. And his son is Alain de Botton, the writer and philosopher.
TV presenter.
Also
remember, everything in those bottles is completely rank and unusable because this is like 10 years after Bacon's death.
Yeah, this is 1998. It's been sitting there, you know, completely untouched for all those years. So, there's probably things in the fridge I dread to think about.
Apparently they made a decision about, well, you will have to move everything out of the house because apparently there were mice started coming and they were eating the bacon archives that were lying all on the floor. So all of these scrunched up bits of paper were getting eaten by mice. And so the Bacon estate said, oh, okay, right, we have to move it because it's just not going to last if we leave it.
No. And then the last picture is the cooker from another angle. There we go. And the final image. So, of course, after Bacon's death and the years after his death, the market for his work went up enormously. It's cooled a bit, I would say, in the past few years, but. This is from, I think, what would say, when would this have been from? Fairly recently. We saw that. This is a 1969 self-portrait, which we saw a few streams back. And that, as you can see...
It was originally given to Valerie Beston, from the gallery.
From the gallery, yes. And it sold for $29,750,000. Yes, Bacon's artwork, his market price went up enormously. I think people have this sort of idea that was the sort of money he was making it when alive. Absolutely not. I mean, this is a sort of product of the weird red hot bubble that has emerged again in the art market, certainly in the 2000, you know, the 2000s and 2010s. As I said, you know, it was sort of wax and wane. But yes, Bacon's work became works from certain periods became enormously valuable. Bacon's, I don't know if mentioned before, three studies of Lucian Freud, which were made in the 60s. I can't remember which year, and they sold for $142,405,000 to. The ex-wife of Steve Wynn, who appropriately was, of course, is a sort of casino and real estate mogul in Las Vegas. So perhaps somewhat appropriate for gambler Bacon, that his highest auction price was given over to the ex-wife of Wynn. Probably in better hands, because of course he's also famous for severely damaging two Picasso pictures, which he was trying to sell both times. He put his elbow through one of them whilst showing it off to various people right before he was trying to sell it. So,
yeah, he has famously bad eyesight, so he didn't judge his distance and put an elbow through a pink period Picasso. Yeah. Bacon was aware of how much money his work was commanding, and so he would often friends would come out of the woodwork and say, "Oh, I really love your work, but you know, I couldn't afford to buy it." And so Bacon sort of sighs and says, "Okay, well, you know, here's a very small picture. You know, here's one of the little portraits. You know, the one that were sort of 10 inches by 14 inches or whatever." And he'd give it to them, and then of course he'd be completely unsurprised when it came up at the auction block at Sotheby's. Which was just down the road from him, you know, like sort of 6 months or 9 months later. And he kind of accepted that was what was going to happen. And also, you know, he was a famous gambler. He'd been in debt before, you know, he knew what, you know, large sums of money could mean to people. So I don't think he begrudged people when they sold pictures, by and large.
No, it's sort of a reality of things. And at a certain point, you know, you're sort of, you know, You've almost got to sell, you know, if you're in that position of owning something that could potentially, you know, you could knock down for $30 million.
And suddenly, A, you've got the insurance, and B, you've got the responsibility of looking after this picture. And the insurance people tell you, well, actually, you know, if you want to keep this picture, we are going to demand that you put a burglar alarm in. We're going to, you know, demand that you put in sort of double locks here and there. And suddenly you're a custodian in a museum that you didn't really bargain for, and often it's quite understandable that you would want to get rid of the picture, even though you might love it, but just simply because it's such a great responsibility.
It's a huge, and you don't want to, and almost it's dangerous to own, you know. I mean, at a certain point, unless you have the security, if it's famous enough work, it's just dangerous to deal with.
Yeah, and you know, what do you do when you go on holiday? You know. You don't want to show people that you've got this work, because this might get out to other people and you become a target and so forth. So it can be a burden. Obviously, this wasn't quite the situation for Bacon. Bacon didn't have very much of his own work. He did, interestingly enough, have some quite old paintings that he'd slashed and just put in a corner and kept. Should I mention the Chelsea cash at this point
before we finish?
So what happened was Bacon died in 92, and then a few years later, out of the blue, someone said, "Oh, look, I have got about, I don't know, what was it, 15, 20 classic Bacons, which had appeared from nowhere, and they were prime period, and this is just unheard of. I mean, because Bacon was not an especially prolific painter, if you count the fact that he destroyed quite a lot of work, and he wasn't making that much work in the 40s and 50s, especially in the early period. He was not, you know, some years he was producing only, you know, two or three pictures a year. But this whole bunch of pictures came out because they had been given. Yeah, this is grey area. What happened was Bacon used to get his canvases stretched by a colourman in, which is an old-fashioned word for an artist material supplier, in Chelsea, which was close to where he lived. Now, when Bacon finished a picture and he wasn't happy with it, he would just say to the colourman, "Come and take this picture away. I want a new, fresh canvas on this stretcher." So you've got a wooden stretcher, which is like a sort of a framework, and then you apply the canvas to it. You can take the canvas off and put a new canvas on. So Bacon was saying, you know, basically, get rid of this. I want a fresh canvas. I'm going to start this over again. What the colourman didn't, well, what Bacon obviously didn't say, or the colourman didn't hear, was throw away the painting. So what happens was the colourman took off the painting off the stretcher, rolled it up, put it in his attic, and returned a fresh blank canvas to Bacon. And Bacon was very chuffed and, you know, got on and did a new picture. And he didn't realize that this colourman had a stock of about 15 or 20 pictures in his attic, which was grey material, because it was not, you know, strictly speaking, well, who owns it? You've discarded it, but, you know, it's a valuable something. So in the end, it was all turned over to the artist's estate. So I should imagine there was maybe some small payment, or I don't know, some sort of arrangement come to with the Cullerman or the Cullerman's relatives or whatever. But these wonderful prime period bacons, some of them which are very good, some of which are clearly unfinished or discarded, but some of them, including a classic Pope painting from the 50s, suddenly turned up and were exhibited and are now absorbed into the corpus. But basically, these pictures were a sort of godsend that appeared many years after his death.
Yeah, and it's certainly, you know, I mean, with an artist, you know, who sort of had a slightly chaotic and casual relationship to his own work, you know, this is the wonderful thing that sometimes happens. You get to sort of see things that, you know, that had sort of disappeared from memory. You know, other artists, you know, you're never going to get a Gerhard Richter painting that you've never seen before, because every single one of them has a number. So there's an enormous catalogue of all of them.
And in my case, I can't, because I've actually reviewed every single painting he's ever done, which is in the catalogue Resonate, which was, wow. I thought would be wonderful, because you get these fantastic catalogues for €250 or €300 each, but then you've got to review like four or five or six volumes of them, and you think, oh God, what did I talk myself into?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been buying the Warhol catalogue Resonate, which has been going on for years, and it's just enormous. I mean, Warhol, of course, you know, famously a prodigious output, but yeah, I mean, it's certainly, if you're a proper writer and historian like Mr. Adams, it can be a major undertaking. I mean, the Bacon catalogue Resonate is wonderful, but it's, you know, it's £1,000 at least. Yes.
Yes, I was lucky enough to get a review copy. Bacon. Oh, sorry, D, you dropped out for a second.
Oh, you back? Am I all right? Okay.
Yeah. So it's a beautiful thing, and it was quite late coming. People were saying, well, you know, have we got all seats to catalogue? So the catalogue Resonate is basically a scientific presentation of all the works, usually in chronological order, for any artist. And there's also an inclusion of works that were discarded, or works that are attributed to, or works that have come from the studio of. And this is a beautiful set, but it's surprising that he didn't produce as many paintings as one might expect. I think this catalogue runs to something like 800, 700 and something.
Yeah.
Which is not a huge production, because, of course, you got to remember that he didn't officially do any drawings, which would
Right. bump up the number. Yeah. Or, you know, and as we discuss his graphical output was, you know, his prints. I'm not terribly fond of them. So, of course, I should say that if people are interested in looking through all of Bacon's work, the Francis Bacon Estate has a website that has, you know, sort of lower resolution versions, but you can look at all of them, and has them in, you know, in order, and gives them all their numbers and gives basic information about them. And I should say, of course, you know, a belated thank you to the Bacon Estate for having all these, you know, these works available. So if people are interested, I believe it's francisbacon.com, something like that.
Yeah, and so some artist estates are very friendly and helpful, and I think we got a little bump on Twitter from the Bacon Estate sort of retweeting or something, which was quite
yeah
nice.
I believe they did retweet one of the stream links.
Yeah, so some artist estates are notoriously litigious or difficult to deal with. The Bacon Estate, I think, has been run very well. And my contact with them, which has been for various reviews and stuff, has been quite friendly and supportive. So I've got nothing negative to say. I mean, I think they're doing a very good job.
Oh, and also for, you know, real estate fans, I believe that Seven Rees Mews sold for £1 million. It was on the market for quite a while. I mean, it's sold, you know, quite a long time ago, probably 10 years ago. But yeah, if you're curious, I wonder in current London prices what it would go for on the market. I mean, it's certainly been greatly improved since Bacon lived there, but
right.
Well, is it time for Super Chats, friends?
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
Before we do that, I do have some breaking news, which is that I've been a little bit distracted for the past 5 minutes because it's come to my attention that Prophets of Doom is number 2 in its respective list on Amazon. But you'll never guess who is number 1. I have never wanted anything more in my life than to dislodge this particular man.
Oh, is it someone beginning with, is it Noah?
Just have a look at this.
It's not that Harari.
It's Harari. No, yes. Okay. Harari is in, it's that fucking Sapiens book.
Based. You've got to displace that. Oh.
Harari is like the end boss of midwittery. He is such a regime kind of avatar of like shitly progressivism.
Disgusting character.
And
yeah.
Look how symbolic it would be if I could dislodge him, if only for a couple of hours.
I went through exactly the same thing when I published Artivism. It was like sort of, I was number 2 and, you know, give us a bump, you know.
Yeah. I have to get... Harari, it's just a symbolic victory of defeating Harari even for a moment.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell us that Sunak had been kicked out or something.
No, although that's coming too. That is also... He is on the ropes. So Alex, who made a bet with me just last night, I mean, as nobody learned that you don't bet against AA when it comes to politics, it's just like the worst bet ever. Sunak's going to be out on his ear by like next week. Easy as £10 ever. I should have made £100. Anyway.
All right, that's all very rank and we won't have it invading this cultural space.
This passage will be edited out of the final version.
There have been three, apart from the bit about needing to dislodge Harari, there have been 3 Super Chats, and they're all from the same person, a certain Port Film Co-op, a man who dissed my top 100 film list, so he's not a friend of mine. But he says... well, and all of his comments are, he said Francis Bacon liked it, you know where, which is hardly news. Port Film Co-op says, forward by Duncan Goodhue, who was a swimmer. And he says,
famously bald swimmer, yes.
Port Film Co-op says, were his visceral attacks on the Pope political? So
no.
The only
substantive last one,
question.
No, not no. Really. But Bacon was a reactionary, and he quite liked hierarchy. And I think back in those days that the Pope was seen as quite sort of distant and untouchable, and the sort of the figure of a man lifted above mankind. So he sort of viewed him in an existential way. But he wasn't Catholic. So, you know.
And that's it. So we've learnt quite a lot about Francis Bacon, easily the most in-depth series on Francis Bacon online anywhere, I would suggest, to add to the other works of D on Deepest Lore. Anything you would like to promote, Alexander Adams?
Well, first of all, thank you very much to AA and Mr. D for allowing me to gabble on at such great length about an artist who I have got a great deal of admiration for. Not the only artist I admire. I do admire many other artists as well. But it's been a fantastic chance to talk about this artist with 2 knowledgeable people. If you want to support my work, you can go to Linktree and follow Alexander Adams Art. You can also go to Substack, Alexander Adams Art .substack.com. If you become a paid subscriber, you do help me produce all sorts of works, including articles, essays, and also me producing art which you can also buy through Imperium Press. I've got a series of lino cuts of reactionary authors there, so you may wish to go and check that out. There will be a new batch launched on the 1st of October.
Dee, anything you have forthcoming?
First of all, I just again like to say thank you very much for Mr. Adams, valuable erudition and addition to this stream, which would not have been possible without him. It was also his suggestion to do it, so thanks very much. And for AA for hosting it. And I will be appearing tomorrow on a program called The Longhouse, which is presented by someone in our circles called A. Walrus. I don't have a link at the moment, but if you watch my Twitter, you will find it. And we will be discussing Slopgate. We will be discussing food. So that should be interesting. And that, I think, is happening tomorrow would it be 7 p.m. British Summer Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the U.S. and 8 p.m. Norwegian time, I think. So anyway, but just look at my Twitter for that link. And also you can follow me for, I occasionally post art and other things. Thank you again.
And all I have to say is, must defeat Harari. It's now my life's mission. It's going to kill me. If that stays stranded at 2 and I can't overtake Sapiens, everything's been for naught.
It's going to be like a Vienna by Ultravox, not getting to number one.
I'm going to have to reconnect with all those magic meditation things. Be like, I have to visualize being number one just to see Harari crying into his WEF tears.
You have to subscribe to that meditation app by Sam Harris.
Yeah, exactly. There's Sam Harris meditations to defeat Harari. Maybe that's how he did it in the first place. So anyway, do buy Prophets of Doom. It's now like your kind of metaphysical duty to do so. And I have turned the fan off for literally 30 seconds just to kind of finish up the show here. And I am already just dripping with sweat yet again. It's so hot here. So I'm gonna probably spend the rest of the day like walking outside, I think, because it's just too hot. But thank you very much for both of you. Very educational. Everything you want to know about Francis Bacon and more. And yes, I have my video tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. It's gonna be it's a pretty important one to catch as far as videos go, because it is it's an excerpt from Richard Hilton's Imperial Obituary, an incredibly hard to get hold of book. It's probably the key chapter in that book. I just read it in full, and I'll probably make that available as a little standalone podcast as well. So, I've learned, Alexander, that if I mention a book, every copy basically just disappears overnight, which then makes it impossible to actually get hold of them. So I have to do my bit to actually make them available where PDFs don't exist and so on. So
I'm waiting for your streams on my books of poetry. Including right. One on Francis Bacon.
Get his book on Francis Bacon as well. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. See you soon. Goodbye for now.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!